The middle of the week and plenty on the radio, from forgotten music hall stars to the writer of Veep and Succession and Strike Up the Band for national anthems. This is Playback Daily. I'm Carol Moran, and here's what you might have missed.
A deaf doula, oh my goodness, there's many things. So it's much more than about just sitting at bedside with someone that's dying. A doula asks difficult questions and holds difficult conversations.
She toured all over Europe with Jack Hilton and famously with Maureen Potter in the La Scala Ballroom in Berlin for Hitler and the Third Reich.
You know, our sort of fictional president was venal and ruthless and selfish, but when she did things wrong, she was punished. You know, overnight, that seemed very quaint and old-fashioned.
And we'll start in the morning, and on Today with Claire Byrne, the mystery surrounding the origins of the COVID-19 virus.
It's almost 18 months since COVID-19 was first identified in the Chinese city of Wuhan, but the origin of the virus continues to elude everyone. While China has linked it to a seafood market, the United States says there's growing evidence that the coronavirus was created in a laboratory. Ross Atkins is presenter of Outside Source on the BBC World News and has recently been looking into all of this, and he joins me on the line now. Good morning, Ross.
Hi, Claire. Good to be with you.
Thank you very much for joining us. Now, early on in the pandemic, the very notion that the pandemic might have originated in a lab and was the result of a leak or a mistake, that theory was roundly shot down at the beginning.
Yeah, that's correct. I think really when the WHO, the World Health Organization, and other, you know, leading scientific bodies looked at this, they were clear that they felt that the most likely explanation was that this virus somehow had moved from an animal to humans and had done so in the normal world, outside of a laboratory. The WHO, in an early statement, said it was unlikely that the pandemic was in any way connected to the Institute of Virology, which is in Wuhan. What's been interesting is the language has definitely evolved, particularly in the last few months. This is still considered the most likely explanation, but particularly because of an intervention by Joe Biden, the lab leak theory, the theory that this virus was being held in the Wuhan Institute of Virology and somehow got out, well, that's been given more credence. A couple of months ago, Joe Biden ordered a 90-day investigation and admitted that U.S. intelligence was split between the theory that this naturally jumped from an animal to a human to the theory that perhaps a mistake was made at the lab. I think one thing that I should be clear on, though, is that there are really three ideas around the pandemic. One is the one that's been given a lot of scientific weight, that this moved from an animal to a human in the natural environment. The second is the one I've just been referencing, that there was some sort of mistake at the Wuhan lab which led accidentally to this virus being released into the community. There is a third theory that the Chinese developed this virus deliberately as some sort of bioweapon and deliberately leaked it. We need to be clear that even though that idea has got traction in some places online, none of the leading organizations investigating this, none of the most powerful countries in the world like America, are treating that third possible explanation seriously. That's been roundly dismissed.
But the World Health Organization, it's keeping the lab leak theory, so option two that you outlined, open, because it's preparing for the second phase of its investigation into the origins of COVID. So it is a legitimate question to ask, isn't it, right now?
It's definitely a legitimate question to ask, and I think Joe Biden's intervention highlights that. I think one of the issues that happened last year with the theory that this could have come from the Wuhan lab was that the loudest proponent of this theory was Donald Trump. And because Donald Trump, when he was president, was a source of such unreliable information so frequently and so politicized the entire approach to the pandemic, a lot of people, because he was focused on that idea, were immediately dismissing it as, oh, this is just Trump being Trump. And actually, what's happened in the last few months is that there's been a broader acceptance within U.S. intelligence, not, and I should be really clear on this, that it was a lab leak, but simply to acknowledge that the lab leak theory requires further examination, and that's what Joe Biden has offered. We do know, there needs to be clear, though, that one of the issues here is that explaining the pandemic and how it started is very, very hard. You know, you can hear any number of scientists emphasizing that being definitive about what happened would be very difficult in any country. Because China is so secretive, it's more difficult still there. And so the WHO's position is still that the most likely explanation is this did just jump from an animal to a human. But because it can't be definitive, it has to leave open the possibility there may have been a mistake at the lab. It, though, is quite clear it hasn't got any evidence that that occurred.
And one would wonder how we'll get to the bottom of this, or if we ever will, because I mentioned the World Health Organization beginning its second phase of its investigation. But the first phase and that visit to China, it didn't get very far, did it?
No, it's entirely contained by what the Chinese decide to show its investigators, and the WHO is open about that. We know that the Chinese authorities control access to most aspects of life in China. They control many aspects of the lives of Chinese people. They're certainly going to control the investigations of the World Health Organization. They don't take the idea of thoroughly investigating this independently kindly. So the WHO is quite open about the constraints on its ability to investigate this. So I think we should be relatively pessimistic about there ever being a definitive outcome. And Claire, if you want an example of how resistant the Chinese are to this happening, go back to the first couple of months of the pandemic. Scott Morrison, the Australian Prime Minister, encouraged the idea of what he called an independent assessment of what happened. And the Chinese took very unkindly to that, and they began taking action on trade with Australia, placing constraints on things like the export of Australian wine. There were consequences for Australia for Scott Morrison saying that. And the bigger context here, and that experience of Australia points to it, is that China is already a huge economic power, and it's only going to get bigger. Within 10, 15 years, its economy will be bigger than America's, and that economic power gives it a huge amount of power, more broad power, diplomatic power, political power, to fend off efforts to properly investigate this. You're right to be a little pessimistic about a definitive outcome.
And Claire asked Ross about the lab at the centre of the story.
And Ross, this lab at the centre of all of this, is it part funded by the United States?
So the Americans have in the past funded some programs that have taken place at the lab. So it's true to say that the American money has been involved in some part of it. But I think it's easy to overstate the degree to which the Americans are central to the funding model of this lab. It's a major lab in China, one of the leading labs of its type in the world, in fact, not just in China. And the bulk of the funding for that comes from the Chinese state. So yes, the Americans have worked with China on programs in this lab. And we need to resist being conspiratorial about this. It's quite normal for countries with leading labs of this type to work with each other on programs. That's the nature of science, isn't it? Science isn't a national endeavor, it's an international endeavor. And quite often, we see this in the space race as well, quite often countries put aside their diplomatic and political differences to work together. Take the International Space Station and Russia and America, for example. So it is true that American scientists have worked on programs at the Wuhan lab, but I don't think you can extrapolate from that that's influencing in any way the American response to investigating the lab. We've got no evidence of that.
I also saw this morning some speculation around what might have been happening at that lab. Dr. Shi, who's the scientist at the centre of all of this, may have been, according to some, been leading so-called gain-of-function experiments. Do you know what that is?
So, well, gain-of-function is quite difficult to explain, but gain of function is a controversial type of work around viruses, and it is definitely true that this lab in Wuhan has been doing this type of work. But again, let's be clear, it's not the only lab in the world that's been doing this kind of work. It's a controversial issue in America, it's a controversial issue in a number of countries, and there are questions about whether adapting viruses, which is essentially what gain of function is, allows you to have a scientific advantage over them, or whether it in fact creates difficulties or risks that are playing out in this pandemic. But we're getting several stages ahead of ourselves here, because there is no proof that gain of function work actually contributed to the pandemic. All that's been raised are existing controversies around that type of work and the risks that it creates. And some people are saying, we need to look at this further. We need to understand gain of function work better, so that we can understand the chances that that could have in some way contributed to this pandemic.
Ross Atkins, BBC journalist, from Today with Claire Byrne. And in the afternoon, Ray Darcy was talking to death doulas, Eileen Pugh and Melissa Murphy.
A death doula, oh my goodness, there's many things. So it's much more than about just sitting at bedside with someone that's dying. A doula is a guide, an advocate, a resource. A doula provides education. A doula asks difficult questions and holds difficult conversations. It's about slowing down and being present to what is. And just for me, it's like, and for other doulas, I think it's about following the lead of the people that we serve, whether it's an individual, their loved ones, the community, and just being with what is and moment to moment what's important to them, and just acknowledging that this time is as sacred as birth and other things that we celebrate and plan for, right? Like births, weddings,
yes, yeah,
anniversaries. Yeah.
And is that the origins of death doulas, that somebody said, well, you have a birth doula, so, mm-hmm, you know, why can't we have a death doula? Is that the way it happened, or is that overly simplistic?
No, I think that's my understanding of it. I mean, I dare say that the doula or the death midwife or doula or companion, all these things have been happening probably since beginningless time, right?
Yes,
where we,
yes,
took care of one another. And we still do. We know how to do this work. We know how to attend to each other and companion each other and accompany each other. But I think, you know, with things that happened in history, it got lost and institutions,
okay,
happened.
So Melissa,
but, yeah.
So you, I'm just trying to understand how it works. So you're, mm-hmm, somebody who doesn't know you contacts,
yeah,
you through,
yeah,
a website or something and asks you to be their death doula.
Yeah.
Right. It does sound a bit strange, doesn't it?
I know.
Yeah.
I know it does. And it's interesting because death, right? Like most people, myself, you know, well, I can't really say myself included because I don't know. I've always been curious about these topics and really drawn to it. But most people in general society, we tend to kind of run away from it, like almost as if we talk about it, then it's going to happen or it's going to come to us. But I find that if I'm at an event, if I tell people what I do, if I'm at a party, when we went to parties, I tell people what I do, then they're actually curious and anxious to share a story, or it's something that's touched all of us at some stage or will touch all of us.
Yeah.
And so, like, what I would have done before I was, now I've just started advertising as such, is I would have volunteered in the community. I would have talked to neighbors and friends, people where I live. I would have had death cafes. And I just talk about it to anybody and I find most people don't run away. Most people say, oh my gosh, that's really something that's needed. We need more of that, or we need to prepare earlier.
Yeah.
Or gosh, this happened to me. You know, I had somebody that I looked after that died last year, and certainly now with the pandemic we've been going through. I mean, it's yeah, much more obviously on the forefront of our consciousness. So.
It's more difficult to navigate for people who was over the last 18 months.
And Eileen is training to be a death doula. She found that path after the death of her own husband, Derek.
He died the 14th of April 2020, just the very beginning of COVID lockdowns and restrictions.
And there's the word, isn't it, restrictions. So how did those restrictions affect, you know, his death and how you approached it and what access you had, etc.?
Well, it was a very different story because of COVID. So we were fortunate in that we had 18 months of preparing.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't know what hit us in the beginning when we got the diagnosis at first, because Derek didn't drink, didn't smoke, was very fit. He had advanced bowel cancer, we didn't realise. No symptoms. And so we went through this overnight. I couldn't put words on it, but I realised soon after it was called anticipatory grief. So that's the journey where you know you're on borrowed time, but how do you live during that?
Yes.
How do you live the best life? How do you prepare for good death?
How do you?
Well, the first thing I'd say is you try and, we restricted ourselves because of chemotherapy. We had to have boundaries, emotional boundaries. We couldn't take on other people's grief. We were trying to live in the present we have today, and we don't know what tomorrow will bring. We don't know. Everything is pulled out from under you. So
yeah,
we did get support. We went to anticipatory grief counsellor. We searched it out. We researched everything Derek asked. he was one of these people who analysed everything, had his clipboard and wanted to know, how will I die?
Right.
What happens?
Yes.
And we couldn't get those answers. We thought we were getting them, but we, in reality, we weren't.
When you say he wants to know how he would die, as in his final moments, would he be in pain? How would he breathe? That sort
all
of thing, was it?
All of that.
All of that, yes. Yeah.
So when you reach the point where you can, if you're fortunate enough to get warning, because lots of people don't, there's sudden death. But if you're fortunate, you'll know there's a time going to come where your body cannot take treatment anymore.
Hmm.
And that's another crossroads. And we got that, I suppose, it was actually August before the following April. And it was saying goodbye to places we loved, to experiences we loved. It was being grateful. Like, there's a huge transformation takes place if a person's open. I can't explain it. You have to journey it.
Is it a liberation? Is that sort of thing? That
absolutely.
Sort of a transformation, right?
Absolutely. It's a soul friend depth. It's a very, very deep experience.
So your relationship with Derek,
yeah.
You know, although you were happily married, etc., etc., but for those months where he'd been told you can't be treated anymore and death was imminent, that's something extremely special.
That is the most intimate.
Is it?
That is the most intimate journey I think any couple can go through. More than births. I've had four births. I think that is just, to me, that is possibly the highlight of living.
Eileen Pugh from The Ray D'Arcy Show. And on the live line with Katie Hannan, remembering the great Peggy Dell.
Some of these days, you're gonna be so lonely. Some of these days, you're gonna miss me only. You'll miss my hugging, you're gonna miss my kissing. You know you'll miss me, honey, when I'm far away. Then I'll feel so lonely.
The wonderful voice of Peggy Dell there. Rob Twamley, good afternoon, Rob.
How are you, Katie? How are you doing?
When did you hear about Peggy Dell?
So, basically, my guitar teacher posted something up about a month and a half ago, 2 months ago, up on the Facebook. It was a picture of an unmarked grave in Glasnevin. And it was Peggy Dell's grave. Peggy Dell. So I decided to start a fundraising campaign to get her a headstone.
And I suppose just to tell people about Peggy Dell, if they weren't around in the 70s when she had, of course, her RT programme, Peg on My Heart. She was a huge, huge star going back to the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s.
Absolutely, yeah.
What was it about her that you decided to take the step? Because, I mean, obviously, she died long before you were even born.
Well, that's it. She died long before I was born. I seen this up on my guitar teacher's page, and I said, I might as well do something about it. She died in 1979.
So it was your guitar teacher put this up and you just looked into it then?
Basically, yeah. So he put it up and I said, that might be something worth looking into. So I looked, done a bit of digging into it, and I seen that, you know, she was quite famous. She had her show on RTE. I read into she'd done some shows in the Olympia and the Theatre Royal. And I put a post up on Facebook, basically my fundraiser, and people contacted me. She done a thing on the Late Late Show with Noel Purcell. And then Noel Purcell's son, Patrick Purcell, actually got on to me saying he'd share it around and see how much publicity we could get for it, you know?
Yeah, and I'm looking at a picture of the grave in Glasnevin Cemetery here, and all this little wooden, I think it's a wooden plaque, little plaque on it saying Peggy Dell, piano player, but no gravestone at all.
Absolutely no stone at all. Now someone actually put, like, I visited the grave there about 2 weeks ago, and there is, like, you can see in the picture, there's a kind of a stone plaque. Someone's kind of hand engraved. It's not fixed or anything, you know, it's kind of just placed there. And obviously, yeah, the stick with the laminated picture as well. Another thing about the grave is that her mom and dad are actually in the same grave, and it's not marked for them either.
Oh. Yeah, it's extraordinary because, I mean, she was such a huge star. How is the fundraiser going? Are you getting much support?
Yeah, I mean, I think you put out a little call or a thing about the show, me coming on to the show, and it's gone up to about €2,000 now. My initial target is €2,500. I'm not exactly sure how much I'll actually need, but €2,500 is kind of a rough guess at how much it's going to cost to get it placed, to get it made and placed on the grave. So any help is greatly appreciated, you know.
Rob there. Then Connor called Katie. He's a music hall expert.
First of all, I have to say fair play to Rob, you know, because I didn't know the situation until he put this up on Facebook and Twitter, and he's done a fantastic job in trying to get a memory of a Dublin superstar as she was back in the day. You know, like, people kind of forget that Peggy Dell just wasn't a Dublin star. She was an international star, because in the early 1930s, she auditioned for the great Jack Hilton and his orchestra. Now, Jack Hilton and his orchestra, big bands were huge back in the 30s and 40s. And she was due to tour with Jack Hilton through the States in the early 30s. And now, she lived just off Manor Street, or Margaret Tisdale, as her real name is. And she said, I don't think I'll go. And there was a small electrical fire in her house that day. And she got up early. She says, well, I'm up now and I might as well go. So she went to the States and she toured all over with Jack Hilton and was a huge success, believe it or not. She really was.
She had an incredible voice.
Yeah, well, it was a kind of a very husky kind of soul kind of singer voice. And that's what really kind of worked in the States particularly. And then, of course, she came back and she toured all over Europe with Jack Hilton and famously with Maureen Potter in the La Scala Ballroom in Berlin for Hitler and the Third Reich. I'm lucky enough to have the recording of that particular radio show.
Connor, stop. Yeah. Stop. Okay. Yeah, Maureen Potter, Hitler, the Third Reich.
Oh, yeah.
What happened?
That's another day. Yeah, like, in those days, well, of course, you know, before, you know, like, or after the war, when everybody found out what was going on, like, bands toured all over Europe, especially somebody of the importance of Jack Hilton. Yeah. You know, he really was one of the top bands across Europe. And they certainly played for Jack Hilton and for Hitler and the Third Reich in the La Scala Ballroom. I have the photograph of the La Scala Ballroom. And there's this huge swastika. Now, unfortunately, it's just the orchestra. Peggy and Maureen aren't in the photograph. But and then, of course, obviously the war broke out and she came back and was on the stage of the Royal for the next, you know, 20 or 30 years. And, like, people kind of forget that the Royal held 4,000 patrons. And, like, there was nowhere like it in Ireland, or certainly it was one of the biggest theatres in Europe. And Peggy would have been one of the stars of those shows. And with, you know, people like Frankie Blowers, the Roylettes, Jimmy Campbell and the orchestra, Nixa Reed, Cecil Sheridan, all these people. But Peggy was one of these amazing artists who, you know.
Yeah, and I was going to say, but her career, you know, obviously would have, you know, waned and gone down with the Theatre Royal as that went. But, but she then had another encore, basically, on RTE. Yeah.
Well, what happened was, as Robbie was just saying there about the tribute, as they used to do on the Late Late to Maureen Potter, they did one on the great Noel Purcell. And I'm a good friend of Patrick's that Robbie was talking about, Patrick Purcell in Australia. And they did a tribute to Noel Purcell. And on it, Peggy Dell played. And people suddenly said, you know, like, they kind of had forgotten you know, if people go out with kind of a bitter memory or they're not seen in the public domain, you know, they suddenly drop out of everything. Because she used to play the piano. There was a furniture shop called Cavendish's in
Hold that thought for a second, Conor, because I'm told that we actually have that clip of Peggy Dell and Noel Purcell performing.
Oh, great.
Thank you, ma'am, says Dan, on the Late Show, and Late. And this was 1973.
You're right. Yeah. What brought you into my room? To my room, to my room. What brought you into my room? Said the mistress unto Dan.
I came here to court your daughter, ma'am. To draw the can, I taught her, ma'am.
Ah, Dan, me dear, you're welcome here.
Thank you, ma'am, says Dan.
How come you to know me, daughter, me daughter, me daughter? How come you to know me, daughter, said the mistress unto Dan?
Going to the well for water, ma'am, to draw the can, I taught her, ma'am.
Ah, Dan, tis you're the handy man.
Ah, thank you, ma'am, says Dan. She's a bunny girl, your daughter, your daughter, your daughter. A bunny girl, your daughter, and I like her well, says Dan.
She's a girl that's fit for any man.
Yeah.
And she has a graph for you, dear Dan.
Yeah.
Oh, Dan, me dear, you're welcome here.
Oh, thank you, ma'am, says Dan.
Now you can have me daughter, me daughter, me daughter. Now you can have me daughter, said the mistress unto Dan.
Great, great.
But when you take me, daughter Dan, you'll take me also, won't you, Dan? Ah, oh, Dan, me dear, you're welcome here.
Thank you, ma'am, says Dan. Now this couple, they got married, got married, got married. This couple, they got married, Miss Elizabeth and Dan. And now he keeps her mother and her father and her brother and...
Oh, Dan, tis you're the lucky man.
I got along to hell, says Dan.
Noel Purcell and Peggy Dell performing on The Late Late Show from 1973, played on the Live Line with Katie Hannon. And on Today with Claire Byrne, we've been listening to national anthems during the Euros. So George Hamilton, RTE commentator and lyric presenter, was talking about some of his favourites, starting with France's La Marseillaise.
Yes, well, this is an anthem that was written back in the day of the revolutionary France. Claude Rouget de Lille, he wrote the music. He was a captain in the army in Strasbourg. The Strasbourg mayor wanted them to come up with something stirring that would boost the local army battalion's morale, and he provided the battle hymn of the Army of the Rhine. And it was wonderful marching music. And the song got its name, the Marseillaise, as opposed to the Strasbourgeois, because a band of auxiliaries from the south of France sang it when they marched up to Paris to join the revolution. And the locals acknowledged it as the volunteer song, the song of the men from Marseille. And therefore, it became La Marseillaise. And since 1879, it's been the national anthem of France.
So talk us through some of your favourites then of the national anthems.
Well, I like that one because of what it is. And it always evokes a kind of a sense of Frenchness. But the Italian anthem is wonderful too. But you think the tradition of opera in Italy, so it's a bit like that too. Fratelli d'Italia, Brotherhood of Italy. Italy has called Italia Chiamo. It was a young poet, Goffredo Mameli, who wrote it in 1847 when Italy was a series of dukedoms and principalities. It wasn't the United Italy at all. But the music stuck. Italy has called, a rousing exhortation to stiffen the sinews and summon up the blood. It's great when you hear the Italian Navy band play it in the Stadio Olimpico just before Italy are about to play rugby. They really go out fired up. And you saw how the Italian football team loved singing their anthem at the Euros as well.
Let's have a blast of it. And going back to the Olympics, George, one of the strongest ones you'd hear was the Russian national anthem. Will we have a listen and then tell us about
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. up they go to get their gold medal.
Oh, yeah, again and again and again. Yeah, yeah, I know. It's wonderful, isn't it? It's it dates from the 1930s. You know, it was really written as nothing other than propaganda by music by a chap called Alexander Alexandrov, because when the Russian Revolution came, they adopted the Marseillaise as their anthem. And then the director of the Red Army Choir, that Alexander Alexandrov, he came up with that one. And they decided that they would use it as the anthem instead of the Marseillaise. But then during World War II, they felt that the more Russian tune was required. And so it was taken over and turned into a kind of a Stalin anthem. And then when Stalin went and Khrushchev replaced him, they dropped the lyrics. Then they got more lyrics. And finally, when it was all over for the Soviet Union and Yeltsin came in, he got another anthem, which was written by the Russian composer Glinka. But back they came under Putin to this song that had been written in the 1930s, the Hymn to the Bolsheviks. They changed the words. And the funny thing is, the words for the Russian national anthem were written by the man who wrote the words for the Soviet national anthem, who wrote the words for the Stalin national anthem as well, Sergei Mikhailov, who was a satirist and the author of children's books. So he three times he came up with a different set of words for the anthem.
That's not an easy feat because, no. You know, the really good ones, particularly at sporting events, they can really fire up the crowd, can't they?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, you'll find the French singing in the Stade de France like the Italian singing in the Olimpico in Rome. They really get behind their teams and join in the anthem with great gusto. And I have to say the anthem in the Aviva or in Croke Park is also sung with gusto as well. I think sports crowds, when they identify so closely with their team and identify with the sport that the team is playing, they really get behind them when they sing the anthem. And it really is something to take, you know, if you're in the commentary box and you've got the headphones clamped to your head, it's a moment to take off the headphones and just enjoy the atmosphere that is created by the singing of the national anthem.
And George spoke about the national anthem of Uruguay.
Like the Spanish anthem, George, that one does have lyrics, doesn't it?
It does have lyrics, yes, indeed. The fact of the matter is it's got 11 verses and it goes over 105 bars, so it's probably the longest national anthem in the world. But in actual fact, they only use the first verse of the chorus when they're playing it now. But you mentioned the words thing. Part of the reason why they got the Russian guy back to do the a new version of the national anthem there was for a period they had no words, and they blamed Russia's failure to qualify for the World Cup in 1998 on the fact that the players didn't get to sing the anthem. They just had to stand there and listen to it. So it's kind of strange. But then the Spanish anthem doesn't have words either, and that didn't stop Spain going on a merry march from 2008 to 2012 through the two Europeans and a World Cup.
Are almost all anthems rooted in classical music? Any modern ones?
That's hard to say. I mean, obviously there are modern anthems for modern countries. They're not necessarily all rooted in classical music. And I think every anthem has its own story, because generally, depending on how it came about. I mean, you know, it's Haydn wrote the music for the German anthem. Mendelssohn was involved, and all sorts of tweaks go along. Yes, of course, countries with a classical tradition are likely to go back into classical music to try and find a source for their anthem. But I mean, as you've heard the tale about the Russian or the French, you know, many of the anthems have their basis in days of yore, when fighting armies were the thing and they were looking for rousing tunes to march to.
The Star Spangled Banner, of course, lots of pop artists have done versions of this one. Houston there, George. I was going to ask you about the dirges, the ones that you don't like.
Oh, I don't want to offend anybody, Claire.
I thought you might not want to.
George Hamilton from Today with Claire Byrne. Now, The Thick of It, Veep, Succession and much more, TV programmes that had Georgia Pritchett in the writing team. She was Ryan Tuberty's guest in the morning, and Ryan asked about writing some of those difficult-to-love characters.
Well, it's interesting. When Jesse Armstrong, the Succession showrunner, asked me if I wanted to work with him on it, I remember thinking, oh no, that would be terrible. I don't want to write for a lot of rich, evil white men. That sounds horrendous. But I think, in fact, the sort of challenge was kind of trying to find compassion for those people or trying to understand them. And that was kind of exciting as a writer. And I think, just as you were mentioning with Sopranos, you know, I think you can sort of slightly fall in love with some of the Succession characters, and then they'll do something and you'll think, oh no, actually they're a terrible person.
Yeah.
But I think it's good to embrace, you know, all that humanity has to offer and to examine that.
But that must be part of your skill, though, where you take us down a little side road. We're on this motorway of unpleasantness, and then you take a little side road to say, but you know what? They did something nice there. And just when you think you're going that way, you screech and bring us back onto the motorway to unpleasantness.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah, they are human beings, just about, and so they suffer, and they all have, you know, faults and foibles and weaknesses. So it's always interesting to examine those.
The thick of it. I want to talk about your book in a second, but just because we fell into this to begin with, The Thick of It, Malcolm Tucker, and how do you incorporate so many expletives into a script for one man to mouth off? I don't know how he learns the script, but what happens in that writer's room? Are you roaring laughing? Are you saying we'll never get away with this? And what?
Yes, both of those. And when I was asked to write on that, I thought very sort of primly, oh, I could never write for Malcolm Tucker. I don't know enough swear words. And then I was asked to write a kind of rant for him. And to my sort of amazement, shame and kind of pride, it just came pouring out of me in a slightly alarming way. And I felt very zen and sort of purged at the end. But yes, it's tremendous fun to write for him, and we all sort of chip in and kind of try and one up each other. And I think, you know, that way you come up with some pretty eye watering stuff. That, well, as you say, you think, are they going to actually film this and put this on television? Mm-hmm. Yes, they are.
Yes, they are. And you know, eye watering is a great expression, because when I'm watching Veep, and I was just watching I watched the whole thing from beginning to, having watched it before, but it went from beginning to end, because sometimes you should listen to an album both sides A and B, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, yeah.
And really enjoy the symphony. And with Veep, which I think is absolute Shakespearean epic comedy.
Yeah.
And some of the exchanges are so fast and so deranged that it's like watching, you know, Djokovic and Nadal playing the most obscene game of tennis you could imagine. In a dystopian Wimbledon.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think the things you make them say are so off colour, they're and so dark.
I know, it's pretty bleak. But it's I think our sort of ambition, if you can call it that when you're talking about swearing, was to not just sort of rely on basic swearing or insults, was to kind of go quite baroque with the swearing and creative and inventive. And and I have got into trouble for that, because my children used my old scripts to draw on the back of, and my younger son drew a lovely picture for his teacher of a rainbow and took it into his school, and then she kind of turned the page over and saw just this barrage of horrific, terrible, filthy, sewer-like language, and she certainly looked at me in a different way after that.
And who wrote this, you poor child? My mother.
Exactly.
What, that lovely lady who's sort of slightly introverted who comes in into the school every so often. Yes. Oh, good Lord. Jekyll and, it's a Jekyll and Hyde stuff, really, is it?
It is, yeah. It is, absolutely.
Is it therapeutic?
It is, yeah. It definitely is. And I, it's funny, when I was younger, my grandparents used to say to me, you know, don't swear, it's not big and it's not clever. And now I feel like saying, guess what? It is big and clever. And <it's> I've made a whole career from it.
It's big, it's clever, it's lucrative, and I'm doing all right. Thank you very much. I love that.
And Georgia has said you can chart the life of a boy in three liquids.
So, yes, the life of a boy, it starts with cowpole, moves on to ketchup, and then on to Lynx. And that's certainly in my family, we're on the cusp of Lynx. We really need Lynx, but we haven't embraced the Lynx yet.
Okay. And how old are your boys now?
They are about, the older one's about to be 15 and the other one is heading for 13. So, yeah, we're right in Lynx territory.
You are banging into Lynx territory. We might come back to the lads in a minute, but if we talk about, God, I've got so many things I want to go to, but I want to go back to the beginning in some ways, because we share an interest in early childhood television in terms of one of the great shows of all time, which is Mr. Ben.
Oh, yeah.
Now, why does Mr. Ben loom so largely in your kind of retrospective in your career?
I think, well, I would like to say that it's, I think, even at a very young age, I was interested in stories and escapism and imagination. And that was just such a brilliant show in terms of him sort of escaping his life and having this different adventure every week. But I suspect that the truth is that I just hoped I'd get to see him in his pants when he changed.
That's the side. You're two sides to a coin. You've got the innocent the innocence of Mr. Ben, who could be a Native American one day, could be a policeman the next day, but quietly the other side he was going, but I just want to see him in his wife fronts.
Exactly. Show me the wife fronts.
Why?
Just young and curious. And, you know, Mr. Ben was hot. You can't deny it.
Now, when you were, again, back to your childhood, you talk about, you know, being very British and not talking about feelings. And I think we had a bit of it here in some ways. We say about it, I often think say about us as Irish people, we talk a lot, but we say nothing.
Right.
not all of us, but certainly someone like myself.
Yeah.
The British thing about not good at talking about feelings, is that an unhealthy trait?
I think it is, really, yes. It doesn't seem to be doing us much good if you look back in history. But, you know, it's all got to go somewhere, hasn't it? And it seems to come out in unfortunate ways. And so certainly social media hasn't helps that. It's interesting that British people are so much better at expressing their feelings when they're completely anonymous. So we're not very good at owning our feelings or kind of being true to ourselves, I think, which is not a good situation.
And Ryan asked Georgia about starting out in comedy writing and being the only woman in the team.
It was pretty intimidating. All the male writers I've worked with have all been completely lovely, and you know, it's a small community really. We all get on very well, but I was very aware that there weren't other women, and I thought that was strange. I used to sometimes say to my colleagues, you know, where are the women? And they'd say, well, you're trailblazing. And I'd say, well, I'm not. I'm doing the opposite. I seem to be putting everyone off because no one's following. So that was strange. But I think if that's all you've known, you just accept it. And it was only after 25 years of writing when Armando left Veep, it became sort of an American-written show. Strangely, it was completely British before that. Mm-hmm. And then when I worked in a, you know, traditional American writer's room in the States, there were two other women there. And it sounds silly, but it was so incredible. It was so pathetically validating to sit in a room with people who looked a bit like me, dressed a bit like me, had similar kind of life experiences and frames of reference. And it absolutely blew my mind, and it was thrilling, and it made me think, gosh, this is what it's like to be a white man every minute of every day. You just see yourself reflected back, you know, whatever room you walk into, whenever you turn on the TV. You know, it makes a real difference. It's great for your self-esteem to kind of look at someone who's like you and think, oh, they're okay, they're good. That must mean I'm good. It made me realise in retrospect what I'd been missing, never getting to work with another woman.
Amazing, isn't it? That and then if you have a room full of, as you say, white men writing the comedy or the drama or whatever, they're simply going to write what they know.
Yeah.
And as you say, then people like me are reflected constantly on the television every day, and they kind of go, well, that's normal. But then you come in and say, well, hang on, you know, we're here too. Maybe you should consider writing this, that, or the other. And suddenly it's fair. It's not equal, but it's fairer.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. You do end up writing about yourself, however hard you try not to. So if every program is written by a white man, then of course that's what we're going to see on TV, or at least that's the authentic, you know, what they can write authentically. And so it really does serve everyone if we get to see authentic stories from all different types of people.
Yeah.
So much more interesting for all of us.
And Ryan asked about the Trump effect on political satire.
Art and life imitating each other comes to mind when, as I was watching the Veep wrap-up in the final season, I was watching CNN reporting on the final days of the most recent president of America.
Yeah.
And I found myself, and I hope you don't mind me saying this, Georgia, I found myself going, I think the CNN version of politics is crazier. Funnier in an anti-comedy way, than the real thing.
Yeah.
More bizarre, more pantomime, more other, and more out there. Almost than this monstrous creature that you created.
Totally.
And what
totally.
Happened though? I mean, that's me as a viewer now saying, "What the hell's going on?"
I know. I mean, that was what was extraordinary. You know, our sort of fictional president was venal and ruthless and selfish and corrupt and terrible in so many ways. But she had a sense of shame, and when she did things wrong, she was punished. And, you know, overnight, that seemed very quaint and old-fashioned. I mean, it's not the worst thing Trump did, putting an end to Veep, but it was one of the things he did. But then I totally agree with you. Life is a much better comedy writer than reality. And when his tenure came to an end with the fantastic punchline of 4 seasons total landscaping, I just wanted to applaud
yes.
life, because I thought, I never would have thought of that. That's just perfect.
I mean, of all the 4 seasons places to, you know, to end up outside with a press conference with Rudy Giuliani, you just think, you couldn't write that. Georgia, you might as well hand in your badge and gun at that stage and say, I'm out.
Exactly.
There's nothing
I'm
I can
hanging
do.
Up my pen. It was just absolute perfection. Brilliant.
On Succession, I'm bouncing around now because I'm conscious we're running out of time a little bit, but you quite like Roman Roy.
Yeah.
And his romance with the older lady, Jerry, is
yes,
so
romance.
Sick.
In inverted commas.
It's so sick. And you know it, Georgia. And I love you for it. Because everyone's watching going, no, 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 no. Where is this coming from?
I think just, you know, trying to get into his psyche and see that he's a kind of broken, dysfunctional man who's incapable of a healthy, loving relationship. So where do all his feelings
go,
and how does he, what terrible attempt at something approaching intimacy could he manage? And I think that's about it.
All right, we're bouncing on to showrunner. Your showrunner for The Shrink Next Door. I watched the trailer for that with Will Ferrell and Paul Rudd. What two of the great talents of our time?
Yeah, that was incredible.
And that was a podcast, wasn't it?
It was a podcast, yes. So we've turned that into a TV show, and it's a true story of a sort of psychiatrist and patient relationship that goes very, very wrong. And Will Ferrell is the patient and gives an incredibly moving, and I mean, he of course can't help being funny, but I think this is one of his most serious roles to date. That he's so moving and extraordinary in it, and Paul Rudd gets to play against type and not be the hero for a change. So that was really interesting.
What a joy to write for that, of course. You're writing Tunnel 29, based on a Cold War Berlin, being directed by their Chernobyl director, Craig Mazin. And working with Simon Pegg on a big screen, a television version of Galaxy Quest. Are there hours in the day for you? I mean, how are you breathing?
There are. I absolutely love writing. So it's all, you know, and I think it keeps me sane-ish. So, it's just a pleasure to work with all these people and get to write as much as I possibly can.
Georgia Pritchett, author of My Mess is a Bit of a Life, from the Ryan Tubridy Show. Now, it's looking like a sunny, hot weekend on the way. So in the morning, Chef Brian McDermott was talking to Claire Byrne about super salads for the warmer days.
Let's start with the broccoli. I mean, broccoli, I was force-fed it when I was young, told I need to eat it, you know, and it's good for my eyesight, it's good for everything else. And I think we all get fed up with it. And then we did it to our own children, just as a kind of reminder to do it back to them, I think. So you change the flavour of it very much by charring it. So the likes of a skillet pan, which is just your rippled pan, if you just put that into the heat and turn it up full blast so it's nice and warm, and your broccoli florets and the stems, this is a great way of using the stems as well, because I'm shocked at how many people just basically throw those out. Cut them and place them on. No oil, no seasoning. Let it char. It's a little bit dry and you think to yourself, God, this is not going great. But for about 5 minutes on a sort of lower heat then of about a medium, when you turn them over, there's almost a toasted sort of look and feel to them. But more importantly, there's a beautiful smell that's starting to happen. And it's about 2 minutes on the other side, because remember, we can eat broccoli raw, but it's best eaten cooked and a little bit of char flavour coming in. It's absolutely beautiful and I just love it.
So to eat it then after you've charred it, do you do anything with it? Are you putting anything on there?
Yeah, I personally do, Claire, and I enjoy it just the likes of in the same skillet pan. It's just add a few pecans, nuts, which you can toast up, and they just get slightly caramelised, and they're adding another dimension to it. And then the likes of just a little bit of soya sauce and a bit of honey and oil, and just mix that up, drizzle it over the top of it. Sometimes I'll reach into the cupboard and get some dried cranberries and a bit of goat's cheese, and that just makes a lovely side that someone will go, oh, this is interesting, what is it? Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden you're getting the broccoli into the kids, or you're getting it into yourself, let's be honest, because we know it's good for us. And that just changes the dimension of broccoli into what I consider is one of the best super sides you'll ever eat, with some grilled meats or fish.
Broccoli transformed there. I want to talk to you about dressing, because you've got a great recipe for a go-to dressing that we can all have ready to go in the fridge.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, through summer, one thing I'll recommend, have a dressing in the fridge. And if you're coming home from work or you're late or you're under a little bit of pressure, if you know you have a bit of dressing in there, you can take some salad leaves and just make them magical within seconds. So here's how you do it. Take 2 teaspoons of Dijon mustard, 3 tablespoons of white wine vinegar, some rapeseed oil, around about 12 tablespoons, 1 tablespoon of local honey, and just, Claire, the zest of 1/2 lemon into a jar. Pop the lid on it and shake the living daylights out of it. That will bring it all together. I mean, I could tell you to add this one by one into a bowl and whisk it, but there's no need, honestly. Shake it into one of the Kilner jars, pop it into your fridge. When it's chilled, okay, it's going to be beautiful, because it's going to kind of, the oil is going to sort of set in it. It's going to get a little bit thick. And then to dress those salad leaves, more importantly, you know, you've got to store salad leaves properly. And the best way to store them, firstly, is to wash them. And you know that the salad spinner that you just spin it dry, that is so important to salad leaves, to keep them nice and fresh. And then into a container with a wet cloth, like a kitchen towel, over the top of them, lid on, and they'll keep for 3 to 4 days in your fridge. But as you're about to dress them, shake that dressing that we put in the fridge last minute over salad leaves. You'll just lift them to heights that you go, wow, there's something really fresh, different and really enjoyable.
Okay, that storage method that you described for the salad leaves, would you use that for the supermarket bought ones, the ones in the bag?
Yeah. And if you are buying those at this time of year, just open up the bag immediately, because I don't know about you, Claire, but if you do get those and you put them into the fridge, you go the next day and you think, God, they've just spilt it, or they're sweaty.
They don't last,
Yeah, and we have so much going on in our fridge, and it's opened and closed on average about 20 times a day. So take them home, open them up, and put them into to just fresh, cold water, pinch of salt in there, and don't leave them in the water. That's make sure not to do that. And just lift them out with your hands into a salad spinner and spin them really dry, because if you don't dry them out, they're literally going to wilt and disappear on you. And then, as I say, just a damp tea cloth or just your kitchen towel paper on top of them and one on the base of it, a lid on. You will always have nice salad, fresh, crisp leaves in your fridge for a few days ahead of yourself.
10 points for anyone who does that today when they go home from the supermarket. Your favourite salad leaf is rocket?
Yeah, I love rocket because I think it's something that possibly should be a herb. It's just full of flavour. And if you're choosing salad leaves, Claire, I mean, they're in season right now, and Irish lettuce in general is in season right now. So perhaps maybe let's sort of glance sideways of that pre-prepared washed bag at this time of year, because you might see a nice head of lettuce and you think, oh God, that won't last. But it will if you do what we've just told you, particularly the likes of rocket. It's got a peppery, mustardy flavour. It's just super exciting on its own. And again, with that little bit of dressing, or serve a little bit of fish that you've maybe pan fried, or grilled chicken, absolutely gorgeous on its own. The flavour's already there for you.
And I should say all of your recipes are up on rte.ie/todaycb. I need to talk to you about tomatoes. I keep tomatoes in my fridge. You say I have to bring them up to room temperature before I use them. It makes a huge difference.
Yeah, well, first off, Claire, tomatoes, keep them in the fridge. They will last longer. That is a fact, okay? So when you know you're going to eat them, and I'm going to be honest with you, you know, I might just say, God, I want tomato, and I'm not going to know 2 hours in advance that I want a tomato. But if you're going to have it as a side or a salad, and you're doing it for maybe a bit of a gathering in the back garden with a barbecue, then we got to get them out of the fridge. I mean, tomatoes are in season right now in Ireland, Irish tomatoes. They're fantastic. And you wouldn't give one of your kids, Claire, you know, a tomato ice pop, because to me that's what tomato from the fridge tastes like. So just slice them, leave them on a tray or on a plate, even just season them up with a little bit of salt and pepper, and that'll draw out the moisture out of them. When the chill goes out of them, the room temperature comes up on them, the flavor improves by 50 to 60%. And what I like to do to enjoy just tomatoes on their own is to do that and then take a little bit of local honey, and even if you have a bit of balsamic vinegar drizzled on them just before you're about to serve them, and that is just a gorgeous way to say wow, that tomato, because every tomato has a different flavor just purely due to the nature of how they grow and how they develop in terms of light, heat, sunlight and so on. But right now we are in tomato season for Irish tomatoes. Okay. So go get the Irish ones.
So that's a top tip. I have never tried honey on tomatoes before. I'm going to give that a go because it sounds delicious, Brian.
Yeah, the sweetness. Tomato as a flavour, Claire, is a little bit bitter. And if the coldness is there, I don't like it. I'm sorry. I just think that there's no flavour there. So the room temperature, then the little bit of sweetness. And if you want, as I say, a drizzle of something like a balsamic vinegar.
Brian McDermott from Today with Claire Byrne. And that's it for Playback Daily. So mind yourself. Till next time.